Welcome to the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast, where we highlight nonprofit innovators, leaders, and influencers every week that are changing the sector for the better. I'm your host, Delaney Mullenix, Executive Director of Nonprofit Hub. If you're not for profit and all for purpose, you're in the right place. You see, we know you're already doing good, but we've designed this podcast to help nonprofit professionals find growth, joy, and connection. So tune in weekly for new episodes to elevate your cause, spread the news, and share the resources we share with you.
We'd like to thank DonorBox for sponsoring today's episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast. DonorBox is the online fundraising engine of choice for over 50,000 organizations in 96 countries. Their intuitive fundraising software was designed with your donors in mind. Go to donorbox.org to sign up today. That's DonorBox.org.
Hey everyone, Delaney here. I had such an amazing interview with Denver Frederick, and it was such an honor to learn from someone who has so much experience in the nonprofit sector. And something that really impressed me from this interview was his kind of like greatest hits, if you will, the experiences that he's had with the changes during the pandemic and the changes in how our community and our world thinks about corporate partnerships. Denver was actually, I personally think, a legacy, no doubt in my mind, but was a major player in the restoration of Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty. And it was one of the first corporate partnerships between American Express and a nonprofit conservation organization. So stay tuned and learn more about what he's learned, not only through his own experiences, but in his passion for interviewing other nonprofit leaders, through which he's actually published his first book. And that book is now available. It published on January 4th of 2023. And that book is called The Business of Giving: New Best Practices for Nonprofit and Philanthropic Leaders in an Uncertain World. Check it out. Denver, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here.
Yes. So tell us more about yourself and how you help nonprofits.
Well, why don't I start with a little bit about myself, and then we'll move on to what I do for nonprofit organizations. As you said, it's been a long time. It's about 45 years in the nonprofit sector, and I have been a staff person, a CEO, and a consultant. And I've also been very fortunate to have been part of some of the more consequential campaigns that have occurred over that period of time that have helped influence the sector in terms of going forward. It was about 10 years ago, Delaney, that I started my radio show in New York City called The Business of Giving. And I thought there was too much bad news out there. And I was witnessing all the amazing things that were being done in the sector and say, why is no one ever talking about that? And I also felt that perhaps we in the sector were talking to one another a little too much, and we needed to get this more in the mainstream. So I did that radio program until the pandemic came along. And then I said, do I really want to go into New York City and speak into a microphone that a lot of other people have spoken into? I don't think so. So I switched it over to a podcast. And as you alluded to before, I've just come out with a book called The Business of Giving, New Best Practices for Nonprofit and Philanthropic Leaders in an Uncertain World. I've probably interviewed somewhere between 500 and 1,000 CEOs over the course of that time. So I try to get some of the essence of what was there. For what I do for nonprofit organizations, I am a certified executive coach, a communications coach, and a trusted advisor. You know this, you speak to a lot of these CEOs, they don't have a lot of people to bounce ideas off of or share their concerns with. So I do that for them and let them know what other people are doing, but I also validate, I think, a lot of what they're thinking already. That tends to spill over in doing other things for nonprofits, such as facilitating executive team meetings and board retreats. And I would say if there's an obsession that I've had, it's been workplace culture. So I started that about 5-6 years ago, and now I've been to over 200 nonprofit organizations to do focus groups on what their workplace culture is like. All those legacy organizations like American Heart, American Cancer, Kennedy Center, United Way, Save the Children, but also the Kivas and the Khan Academies of the world, and to figure out, hey, how do you hire onboard performance management, innovation, trust, transparency? So I do that for a lot of nonprofit organizations as well.
Yeah. Were these interviews, did you know going into these interviews that you were writing a book on them, or were they interviews for providing consultation?
I did it as a hobby, as much as anything. I really love the sector and I spent a lot of time. I had no idea of writing a book at all until maybe a year or so ago. Yeah. And then somebody said, hey, would you ever think of taking all this information? So I did it, and I didn't even do it in terms of a consultation as much as anything. I just, I really enjoy the sector. It's been really good to me and I like to learn. And to be quite honest with you, you get to the age that you almost have to force yourself to learn. So when I have an interview the next day, and I have to, you know what it's like to prepare for these interviews, you have to read the book or you have to force yourself. And you wouldn't do that unless you knew you had a 9 o'clock the next morning.
Yeah.
And I think we can both fake 10 minutes. You can't fake 40 minutes.
Yeah.
You really have to know. Otherwise, you're just going to be saying, what else? What else? What else?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. Well, after kind of digging into more of your history, I mean, you are a legacy in that you led a campaign to restore the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island, which is amazing. What were some of the most rewarding and most challenging things that occurred during that campaign?
Well, it wasn't an amazing time for me. I was incredibly young and really had no business in getting that job. I kind of lucked into getting that job. I had not had that much experience. And I think as I look back now, there were two things from that campaign that have really lasted. So if I talk about what's rewarding, maybe I'm doing it with hindsight as part of my view. One was that it was the first campaign ever to be a corporate sponsorship campaign. Up until this time, all support of nonprofit organizations was philanthropy. And this was the first time that a nonprofit organization actually went to the marketing budget of a corporation and then had that corporation embed that cause into their advertising, into their public relations. And I'll tell you, to this day, I can still remember our first foray into that. It was done with American Express.
Okay.
And it launched on October 5th of 1983. It ran until the end of that year, December 31st. And what their deal was is that they decided they would give one penny for every time the American Express card was used to the restoration of the Statue of Liberty, and $1 for the issuance of every new credit card. And during those 90 days or so, we raised $1,733,000. But more importantly, we really put this campaign on the map. And American Express increased their credit card usage by 29%.
Wow.
And their issuance of new credit cards by 45%. So this was the birth of cause-related marketing. We then went on to get 20 more sponsors, you know, Kellogg's, Chrysler, American Airlines, and just from the corporate sponsorship program, raised over $100 million. So that would be significant. I think the other thing that was significant about that effort, it was that it was the first public-private partnership that had ever been undertaken. Now, we hear public-private partnership, it kind of just rips off our tongue and you think they've been around forever, but they weren't. And this was a case where private philanthropy and individual Americans were going to be giving dollars to support something which was part of the federal government. The Liberty and Ellis Island are part of the National Park Service, which is under the aegis of the Department of Interior. And this concept of having the private sector support public lands was novel. If you ask me about the challenges, I would say the challenges in some respects were those two things. The resistance we got to corporate sponsorship was monumental. How can you be selling our national symbol, Lady Liberty, on a market exclusive basis to American Airlines? It's tawdry. You can't be doing that. And the other thing, in terms of the public-private partnership, a lot of volunteers, Delaney, would not participate. Because it philosophically, they felt that this was inappropriate to have the private sector. It was an abdication of federal government responsibility. That obviously faded away. And now we look back and nobody ever thought those two things would have been issues.
Yeah.
But those would have been two of the biggest challenges that we faced.
Wow. That's interesting. Yeah, I would not have. Now it's more like we want the private sector to get more involved.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Going back to something that you said about the pandemic, I mean, your book is focused on new best practices for nonprofit leaders in an uncertain world. So how many of the interviews that you did were post-pandemic?
Oh, hard to say because I don't count them, but there are well over 100. Maybe 100. I mean, an awful lot. It was hard to say. I was doing some weeks during the pandemic, I was doing 10, 15 interviews a week.
Wow. You mentioned, I think in one of the synopsis of your book, that obviously all sectors were hit pretty hard by the pandemic, but can you explain why the nonprofit sector was amongst one of the hardest?
That's a good question. And I think one of them reasons would be lack of financial reserves. And this is part of the catch-22 you have in this sector. I think there are too many analogs to the business world in the nonprofit sector. I'll give you an example. If you start a business, Delaney, and you start to sell more and more and more, you're going to make more money and everything is going to be happy. But if you start a nonprofit organization and you have a program that everybody loves and you do more and more and more, it's going to cost you more money to do it. You're going to have to get more philanthropy. As it relates to financial reserves, we're looked upon by, I think, outsiders of not wanting to have too many financial reserves. If you're a nonprofit organization and you have too many financial reserves, people are going to say that money could be put to better use. And there are people who need help and they're sitting on this money. Along the same lines, a donor is going to say, well, look at all the money that they have in the bank. They don't need our money. Let's find somebody who's a bit more desperate and give that money to them. So you get penalized for good financial stewardship. And then when a crisis hits, people say, oh, that silly nonprofit organization, those do-gooders, they don't have any financial reserves. Well, they set up a system where they don't allow you, you know, right, notwithstanding Harvard. So that would be one thing. The other thing is technology. The nonprofit sector was behind in technology. But again, part of it is for what I just said. IT has been considered an expense. And if you want to keep 92 cents of every dollar going to program, you tend to skimp on technology. So by not having the technology, the nonprofit sector was behind the eight ball. So people need in the sector, and I think they're beginning to look at IT not as an expense, but as a strategy. And right, the third thing that I think hurt the nonprofit sector was the Great Resignation. Everybody was hit by the Great Resignation. You know, anytime you have two job seekers for one job two jobs for one job seeker, is going to be tough. But when you then get into the competition of salaries and things of that nature, it makes it increasingly difficult for the nonprofit sector to both recruit and retain talent.
Yeah. What, these are all, you know, some negative side effects of the pandemic, but were there any positives that came out of the pandemic for the sector or its leadership? Like, do you think technology adoption has been increased since then, or?
I think it's been dramatically increased. I think it's become a lot of the center of a lot of people's theory of change. I do think there's been a big movement and acceleration to trust-based philanthropy. And perhaps this is best manifested, and I know you know this, by unrestricted giving, that people realized that nonprofits were in a crisis and nobody knew what was going to be coming next. So funders took off the restrictions on the money that they gave and said, use it any way you want. And now people are beginning to say, why in the world did we ever have those restrictions in the first place? It really never made any sense. So I think that the idea of trust-based philanthropy, unrestricted, you know, I had one guy on my program who basically said, if I know better what to do with the money than the nonprofit organization I'm giving it to, maybe I shouldn't be giving them the money in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like if you and I went down to Federal Express to send a package, and then we said, hey, I don't want any of this money to go to gasoline. And I certainly don't want it to go to you because you're overhead. We have lived with things in the sector which we've assumed are the natural order of things. And I believe that the pandemic has really upset that natural order. And people are beginning to look at things and say, why was it that way in the first place?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I love the concept of trust-based philanthropy. And I think I've heard the word trust used as the theme to many conversations that I've had with different product and service providers for the nonprofit sector, especially technology companies. And so I think that will be a big word in 2023.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I also would say that I think one of the things the pandemic that has made difficult for nonprofit organizations, but I would say for other organizations as well, is this concept of teams. And Zoom, I have found to be a great tool for vertical communication. So if I am part of the marketing department I can communicate up and down with the marketing department very, very effectively. It is not so effective, though, for horizontal communications. And you're seeing very few departments that are being influenced by an adjacent department. So I think what you're finding is you're finding a lot of great teams in nonprofit organizations, but you don't have one team. And that's what you really want to look for, is that one team. And I think Zoom has been a challenge there. I also think Zoom is great for talking, but I don't think it's great for listening. So I see people sometimes when they speak their piece and then they're back to their phone and they're doing other things. So I think that that has been one of the things where the pandemic has really kind of hurt that level of communication and that integration across an organization.
Yeah. Nonprofit Health's previous executive director was super passionate about this, like the, how many restrictions are on funds and how there's like this myth that the donor is the expert. And she always said, you know, the donor is not the expert. You are the expert of your mission.
That is absolutely true. And I also would even take it a step further, and I'm sure she did as well. Then the people you're serving sometimes are the expert of the mission, even more than the nonprofit organization. So it's the old line, the closer to the problem, the closer to the solution. And you're seeing, I think, a lot of nonprofit organizations just not listen to, but really give some decision-making capacity to people who are in those communities. You know, one thing that I found interesting, Delaney, organization I was working with, they find that often in those communities, they don't want nonprofits and philanthropists to come in and fix things. They want the money to go to things that they're already doing well.
Yeah.
Why don't you, it's sort of like Strength Finder, you would find. This is what we do exceedingly well. How about you give us more money to accelerate that, as opposed to coming in, telling us what's broken here, and then trying to fix things that are already broken or whatever. It sort of gives us a complex that, you know, that everything is broken. So you're beginning to see that donors and nonprofits are moving from the driver's seat to the passenger seat. They're letting the people who are leading those communities themselves in the driver's seat, and in the passenger seat, what we're doing is we're paying the tolls. And that seems to be a really good analogy for me.
Hi, this is Kevin Burgess, the editor of the Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast, and I'd like to tell you about today's sponsor, DonorBox. DonorBox has a simple mission: to do everything possible to support nonprofit organizations in their efforts to make a difference. From hitting your first campaign goal to growing into a sustainable and thriving nonprofit, DonorBox makes it easy for organizations to maximize donations and attract more supporters. From charities to social impact groups to faith-based organizations, DonorBox delivers a simple, seamless donation experience for your supporters. So visit DonorBox.org to sign up with no setup or monthly fees and no contract required. That's DonorBox.org. Now let's get back to Delaney and the rest of her conversation with Denver Frederick.
All right, everyone, here is what we've been waiting for. Denver is going to share his most memorable interview. Well, maybe not the most one, but I asked him to share significant interviews. And Denver, who is this interview with?
Well, this was perhaps the hardest question I've ever faced. Because I've done about, as I said, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 interviews. And each of those interviews is so special in its own right.
Yeah, it's like someone asking you what your favorite movie is. I could never decide what my favorite movie is or my favorite song.
Or if you have six kids, who's your favorite? You know what
I mean? Ask that question.
And so you're like, I don't know. But probably about 95% of the interviews I've done have been with nonprofit leaders. And the other 5% have been done with thought leaders. So I decided I'd take a thought leader here it's a bit more neutral territory. And that thought leader would be Jim Collins. Are you familiar with Jim Collins?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He is obviously a Good to Great, the author of and Good to Great in the Social Sector. And he was a wonderful interview on so many different in so many different ways. But one of the things we talked about was the flywheel effect. And this is a monograph that he had just come out with at the time. And we all know about flywheels. They're big, 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 heavy wheels, and they're almost impossible to turn. They weigh so much. And it takes a tremendous amount of energy and force to get a flywheel going. Everything you got, the thrust, the muscle, to just get it to start to turn. But After you get it started to churn, it begins to take on a life of its own. It begins to accelerate and accelerate, and then the momentum gets to be such that it's just churning on its own. And he believes that every nonprofit organization has their own flywheel, mm-hmm. and we need to create a flywheel. And let me give you an example of one. It won't be from a nonprofit organization, but it will be from one that I think all listeners can understand, and that would be Amazon. Amazon is a classic case of a flywheel. And at the top of their flywheel, Delaney, they have low costs. And they made their name with low costs that led to the next thing, which got more and more traffic coming in. People said, wow, look at these books. You can get them at a discount. That got more traffic coming in to Amazon. When more traffic came into Amazon, third-party sellers began to say, ooh, there are a lot of people going there. Maybe I want to put my product up there. So I'll put my Hoover vacuum cleaner and my gloves and my shoes and my computers. And that got more third-party sellers coming in. Those third-party sellers, in effect, lowered the prices even more because the fixed costs went down dramatically in terms of the web, the service delivery, the warehousing, et cetera. And that then had more people come in that accelerated it in terms of trying to get the selection and get more low costs. And it goes around and around and around and around. So we discussed that with the Cleveland Clinic and a number of other nonprofits that he studied. And I have to tell you, I've done this with a lot of nonprofits I work with. And the reason I brought up this interview, it was something that I think your listeners can think about. What is your flywheel? And you find out that these things, one follows the other. You can't switch the order. They have to be in sequence. And it's a very good way to tell your story. It's a good narrative. It's something that board members have appreciated, mm-hmm. volunteers, donors, because it provides a logic that they can remember in terms of how this business model works. And we each have a flywheel. And I would really urge listeners out there to think about yours and what it would be. And as I said, it's really been useful concept that I've used with a number of nonprofits.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm probably going to think about ours now too after this interview.
It's not that easy, actually.
Right.
But yeah. It does make sense, and it helps make sense of everything you're doing in some kind of a logical way.
Yeah. Yep. Well, let's talk about decision making. Chapter 3 in your book is called Decision Hygiene. And when we're in an uncertain world, quick thinking and soundness in your decisions is almost impossible, especially after a period of prolonged stress. I remember when the first conference that I helped to organize with Nonprofit Hub Cause Camp this year, I was so stressed by the time that the conference finally came that it was in May. So the weather where the conference was being held was, you never really know what it's going to be like in May. It could be freezing. Yeah, right. It could be really beautiful and warm. And we had hired a live musician to play out on a patio. And the day of the conference, it's like 30 degrees, just absolutely dismal outside, rain, freezing sleet. And I was so tired by the end of this day. So the musician arrives and he's like, where do you want me to set up? And I was kind of like looking around, like, I don't know, should I still have him go outside? Should I have him stay inside? I don't know. we rented this patio, like we already paid for it. Like we paid for these heaters. And I kind of just like went to go find like my boss to like ask her what she thought. And I knew my boss didn't care, right? Like my boss wanted me to just make the decision and like move on. And I just like could not do it. And I remember looking at the catering people. And so these were like the caterers for the conference. And I just looked at them and I said, I literally cannot make this decision right now.
Wow.
Like, could you please tell me what you do? Like so burnt out. Like I could like literally that part of my brain, I could not do it. I couldn't make a decision.
And you didn't have a coin with you, apparently.
No, I didn't have a coin. But like when you're in this like prolonged stress state, like having to make one more decision is like, you can't do it.
Yeah. No, that's a great story in terms of you just get to the point where you don't know, you don't trust yourself either. Yeah. You know what I mean? You don't know. And you're so clouded in your judgment. And particularly if you've made a couple of decisions, which maybe have not been the best decisions, you're like, I'm going to make another bad one here. What do I do? Well, it's a really thorny issue in terms of how leaders went about making decisions. And I have to say that the best thing that they did is that they had a real clear definition of success. And people sometimes, when they think about decision making, they don't think about that crystal clear definition of success they have. So having been around a lot of nonprofit organizations, when I ask people to tell them what their definition of success is, I will get different answers from different departments, as you well know. And sometimes you get different answers from different individuals. You do need to have a very clear definition of success. What is it? And what does it look like? And everybody has to be on the same page with what that definition of success is going to be. Once you've been able to do that, when these decisions come up, you can easily say, hey, is this taking us closer to success as we've defined it, or is it not? Or are there other options that would take us closer to success? So a definition of success is a prerequisite, I think, for good decision making. The other thing that I find is the contrast between one-door decisions and two-door decisions. And I've looked at two-door decisions. When I begin to envision it, I think of the doors going into the kitchen at a restaurant. And there are two doors, as we well know. There's the door into the kitchen. There's the door out of the kitchen. The reason you have two doors and you only go through the appropriate door is we don't want plates flying all over the place. About 95% of the decisions we make are two-door decisions. In other words, what you do is you make the decision, you go into the kitchen, so to speak, you see what's around, you say, oh, this is a bad decision, you flip it, and you go right out the kitchen again. And it takes 2 seconds. But those decisions are good because you learn, you get feedback, you create energy, you move the organization. About 95% of them are going to be two-door decisions. Mm-hmm. One-door decisions are a little bit more consequential. They take a lot more thought because once you've made that decision, it's not that easy to undo.
Yeah.
Hiring a new CEO, getting that person wrong. Well, you can always undo it, but it costs time, it costs money, it can paralyze the organization.
Yeah.
Too many leaders take one door decision time on two door decisions. So what you need to do is really increase the velocity of your decisions. And I think this happened a lot during the pandemic. I spoke to the CEO of Komen, the CEO of the American Cancer Society. They said, hey, I'm accustomed to having 70-80%. I didn't have it. I had 40% or 50%, but I knew I had to make a decision with a lot less information because the decision was going to be made without me if I didn't do it. So there was this speed of decision making. And I think speed of decision making is key. Final thing I say is that you have to get really honest input from people who are around you. And one of the ways that leaders need to do that is that they can't show their hand about what they think. I find leaders sometimes asking for people to vote on something before the meeting starts, not at the conclusion of the meeting. If I step into a meeting and say, we're thinking about expanding our program to include young adults. We've had some consultants in. They think it's a great idea. I've spoken to the board. It really looks promising. But, I never would do that without you guys weighing in. Well, guess what? They're going to want to do it, not because you're right, because you're the boss. Mm-hmm. So you have to create situations where people can speak freely. They can speak openly. A couple of organizations even do pre-mortems to give people permission. If this decision is bad, why is it bad? So somebody will play a role as mm-hmm. to it failed because of the such and such, and they don't have to portray themselves as being negative. They've been asked to play this role. So I think those are some of the keys that are really key to good decision making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, during the pandemic, it was like everything was changing. Like the CDC couldn't even make decisions, right? Like
right.
No one knew. And every day, I mean, it was always a two-door decision because you were always having to leave and like start over because there was something new that was learned or it was no longer relevant. And so, yeah, I mean, that was a crazy time.
Yeah. Just don't not make the decision. And that's right. What happens. It creates movement. It creates energy. You learn from it. And I think the more decisions organizations can make along those lines. Look, we can't figure things out. I mean, the best movie producer in the world will try to figure out a movie and it will flop at the box office. So people who are even experts don't really know until they get, they find out and they see it. And I think that is really critical.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. So, I mean, on this topic of like periods of prolonged stress and all of that, I mean, burnout is real. And I feel like it's something that's talked about in the nonprofit sector a lot. I hope one day it's not talked about as much. Mm-hmm. But what is an essential practice that leaders can do to keep themselves healthy so that they can make these quick decisions when they need to?
Well, that's a big topic, as you well know. I think one of them is to show vulnerability. I think the old model of a leader having all the answers, being the go-to person, making all those decisions. So I think that the more a leader can say, hey, I don't really know. I'm vulnerable here, and seek help. I have found some of the best leaders will go to their organization and give them what their vision is, but then tell everybody there that they don't really know, don't know how to go about achieving it. You know what that does? It gets everybody sitting at the edge of their seat and really engaged and say, oh, I can help do that. I have some ideas on that. You know, you contrast that with somebody who says, I got everything figured out. This is our vision and this is how we're going to get there. Oh, okay. That's what the boss wants me to do. I'll go through the motions. So I think showing vulnerability is really key, and asking for help removes a lot of pressure. I remember the head of the New York Philharmonic, she went out to Los Angeles for 17 years, and I asked her what had changed in those 17 years before she returned to the New York Philharmonic. How has New York changed? And she says, oh, it hasn't changed. I've changed. I used to think I had to have all the answers. Yeah. Now I'm kind of a keeper of space. I hold space and let others come in and contribute. So there's this whole different dynamic, I think, of what leaders are being asked to do. Second thing I would say is that we need to focus on the environment and not the person so much. So when you look at burnout, what we do is we say, get some exercise, eat better, get some sleep, take time off, do some mindfulness. Well, about 30% of what we do is us, and about 70% is the environment that we're in.
You put that healthy, you know, fixed person back in the same environment, it's just going to happen again.
Yeah, you know, a great way to visualize it is the canary in the coal mine. Well, a canary in the coal mine is the old expression to show that there's danger and stuff like that. Well, when you have the canary in the coal mine, we don't focus on the canary and say, I'm going to turn the canary into an eagle or a buzzard or a vulture. We focus on the coal mine. You know what I mean? And we got to fix the coal mine. Yeah. So I think the more that we can begin to focus on the environment and not so much on the individual, and that doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing those things, obviously. And the last thing I'd say about that is that I think leaders, in terms of avoiding burnout, they need to appreciate how far they've come and what they've done. And there's a story about this that was told to me by Gail McGovern, who's the CEO of the American Red Cross. And she took over that job in about 2008. But before that, she had been at the telephone company. And she said she remembered at the telephone company, there was a story, whether it's apocryphal or not, it doesn't make much difference. But there's these two guys, and they're laying telephone poles on down an interstate highway. And one of them is looking ahead as far as the eye can see. And he's saying, oh, my gosh, look at all these telephone poles we have to. You were never going to be able to do that. It just goes on forever. At which time his teammate taps him on the shoulder and says, take a look behind you. And looking behind him, as far as the eye could see, they looked at all the telephone poles that they already had laid. Mm-hmm. And she says she always is reminding people at the Red Cross to every once in a while to take that look back and appreciate all that we've been able to achieve, because there's a penchant in the sector to look at what we haven't done, who we haven't reached, and we're never going to get there. And I think that moment of appreciation is really important, both for a leader and for the team that they're leading, to really see how far they've come and to soak that in now and again.
I love that analogy. I was thinking back to a podcast interview that I did a couple of weeks ago with a really young gal who was not even 18 yet. And she had started a nonprofit organization that already grew to 24 different international chapters before she graduated high school. And like her capacity for leadership was so high at such a young age. And I remember something she said that I kind of thought was really beautiful. She mentioned of a challenge, like she had these high highs and these low lows in, you know, what she did in these circumstances of this low, like, what do you do? And, she said, you know, I always thought that when the nonprofit had challenges, that it was a threat to my leadership. Mm. And she said, I've learned to not be that way anymore. And I'm like, that's a really, I mean, that's a great way to say it. Like if there was even a challenge, like any challenge, external challenge, that to her was like a threat to like her own leadership. And so she wouldn't typically like be vulnerable with people and say like, we're facing a challenge right now. So I thought that was a cool.
And the key thing about challenges is to face new challenges. I mean, the problem is sometimes organizations continue to face the same challenge month after month, year after year. Mm-hmm. And the sign of progress is not challenges going away. They're new challenges and different challenges. One thing for the individual, this was a tip I got from a woman in Australia. I said, how do you get away in terms of your own self-care? And she said what she did is she had her assistant change all her passwords on her social media accounts or email accounts and things of that sort. Her assistant can get in touch with her when she needed to. But she said, I am not even tempted when I'm away to look at anything that's going to be coming in. Because if it's in your head, it can gnaw at you. And it was a great piece of advice, I thought, for really just cutting everybody off and getting away and getting the rest and the relaxation you need.
Yeah. I mean, it gets harder. I think the higher you work your way up in a company, because when I was younger and earlier in my career, I never had anything on my phone that had to do with work. Like I actually refused. I'm like, there's absolutely zero reason why I need to have something on my phone for work. I didn't have my email. I didn't have any applications. I didn't have like a work phone number, nothing like that. And now I'm like a very like OCD, like organizer in my app. So I have like a folder for work now on my phone. And I mean, it's Calendly, it's Google, it's Proposify, it's our CRM, it's our membership network. It's like every single thing that I do for work is now on my phone. and it literally has gone from like zero to like 100.
How does it feel?
I don't know. Like in a way, like, right. This is like the thing about technology is that, wow, how amazing is it that I can literally do everything that I would possibly have to do just on my phone. So if I'm traveling for work or anything like that, I could literally access everything I need.
Can you get away from it though? Or are you addicted?
I would say probably I'm more addicted than anything. Because if I'm like, right, if someone else is driving and I'm in the car, I can pull up in Slack. I can pull up in my email. Like I can just like check in, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas before that was never even a thing.
No, I think it happens to all of us with work and things of this sort. And even if your brain doesn't want to do it and you don't want to do it, your hands haven't gotten the message.
Yeah.
And they just go. And next thing you know, you're off to the races. And, you know, often when something gets in your head like that on one of those little things you've taken a look at, you have to deal with it. You can't just say, oh, that's happened. You know, it's like, oh, wait, I have to do something, you know? And there goes the vacation.
Yep. Yeah. Well, we typically end every interview with a segment called Good News for Nonprofits. What is a bit of good news for the nonprofit sector that you can share?
Boy, there's, again, I always have like 500 different answers for all these different types of things. I think one of the things that's encouraged me has been this acceptance and this movement towards systems change. And, you know, systems change is shifting the conditions that hold a problem in place. That's been my favorite definition of it. And I've looked at America as being program rich and systems poor. And I believe that one of the things that's come out of the pandemic is that we recognize that these systems are producing these outcomes and that the programs that we initiate really can't do a lot to move the needle. We have to change the systems themselves. And I'll give you an example of that. This came from the head of the Annie Casey Foundation, but she said, let's take a look at education in underserved communities. We finance education in this country through property taxes. In addition to the state, the local financing is a property taxes. If you look at underserved communities, particularly communities of color in the city, those values of those properties are not that much. The average white family is, I think, has wealth of 10x compared to a black family. And because of redlining and other practices, they are depressed real estate prices in those communities. Yet that is how we finance education in communities across the country. So I think that people have begun to realize that unless you change some of those systems, we are not going to be able to make the movement that we need to make. I think a corollary to that is that donors have to begin then to change the way they evaluate their contributions. You know, if we want to fix hunger in this country, you don't do it by seeing how many more people you fed this quarter compared to the last quarter. You have to have a different time horizon. You have to have a longer time horizon. And I think that's what's something that donors are going to have to do. They're going to have to reevaluate the impact that their contributions are having. And with this system change, I'm really seeing for the first time some very sincere collaboration on people who have never collaborated before at a much, much deeper level. They're building relationships with each other where all collaboration starts. And it isn't one of those things where we get together and we talk about things and then we go our own ways. It really does seem to be a deeper and more sincere level of collaboration. So I would say that for me, who kind of just love this stuff, I find that to be one of the best pieces of good news that we've had in the sector in quite some time.
Yeah, I agree. That is good news. Well, Denver, it's been a pleasure learning from you and hearing more about your experiences. I'm super excited to read the book. I can't wait. But remind everyone again when that book comes out, January 4th.
Well, the book is on January 4th, so it should be out already. It's called The Business of Giving, New Best Practices for Nonprofit and Philanthropic Leaders in an Uncertain World. And it really takes all the wisdom that it's not my wisdom. It's the wisdom that these leaders have provided and tries to do so in a very concise, curated way. And hopefully will give people something that they can take action on when they go back to the office on Monday after reading the book. And that's what my hope will be. And it's been an absolute delight to be with you, Delaney. Thanks so much for having me, and I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Denver.
Thanks for joining us for this Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast episode. For more resources on fundraising, marketing, and all things nonprofit, be sure to check out the number one nonprofit toolbox at nonprofithub.org. We hope you'll join us next week for another episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast.